Accession number 26848, Reel 11.
Mr. Broomfield, Reel 11. Now, we got to the point where you're on HMS Blenheim at Port Barry in the docks. The ship's just come back from overseas service, but you've just joined it. Now, I believe you've got a couple of stories that sort of give us a taster of some of the seamier side of life in some senses.
At Barry Docks, we were allowed ashore periodically. We were doing watchkeeping. And one of the things I remember doing there is we were able to buy duty-free cigarettes. And I used to line up for inspection before going ashore by the officers, and I'd have a few packets of cigarettes in my socks, and then when I went ashore, I would sell them in a pub, make a few bob, and that would be part of my expenses for the evening. Also,
so how would you put them in your socks?
Well, I normally would put four packets in each sock, two at the side, one at the front, one at the back. So it made the sock nice and tight, and they were quite secure. Sometimes you only had the one packet; they could be a bit loose, and I was a bit worried that they drop off and give the game away.
And they'd be concealed.
They were concealed because I've got bell bottoms on, and you had plenty of room down there, and officers didn't bother looking down there, and away you went.
And was there an organised black market, or was it informal?
It was informal. You'd just buy the cigarettes, as you were allowed to do, and you'd just get them ashore as best you could, and then sell them to the people ashore at bargain prices, for as far as they were concerned. The other thing I did while I was there was a lot of dockyard navvies on board the ship. I think the ship was being broken up, but anyway, they were working on it. Each day they'd be on board, and they were obviously taking things off the ship that they thought might be useful to them. And just beside the wireless office, there was the captain's sea cabin, and on his bunk there were some nice blankets. And I was sending my own blankets up the line to be laundered by post. So I hit upon the idea of parceling up some of these blankets one by one off the captain's bunk, because he didn't need them anymore, he'd gone off the ship. And I thought, well, if I don't take them, the dockyard navvies will take them. So I parceled them up and I sent them home, and I put them on my own bed eventually when I came out of the Navy.
So he just left them when he left the ship?
Yes, they were part of the ship's bits and pieces. A lot of the stuff was being taken off the ship and thrown away. Wireless gear, all sorts of stuff. I'm pretty certain the ship was in to be broken up and they were just taking anything useful off it. And if I hadn't taken these, somebody else would have done.
And a third story was a story, I think this was before when you were in Portsmouth, but if you want to tell that.
Yeah. Another occasion when I went into Barry, the prostitutes used to be on the jetty waiting to accost the sailors, and I'd never been with a prostitute, nor did I want to, but I went into these pubs in Barry, and on one occasion I was with a couple of pals and they were at the bar, and a chap came across and he wanted to introduce me to what he said was his niece, quite an attractive girl sitting at a table with him, and me being a perfect gentleman shook hands with her. And he wanted to buy me a drink. I said, well, no, I've got one up on the bar and with my mates. And then he lifted up her skirt, and there's also civilians in this pub, men and women, and they didn't turn a hair. He just lifted up her skirt to show me her underclothes, and what he was trying to demonstrate to me was that she was clean and I could go with her and wouldn't catch a disease, and he could recommend her because she was his niece. And I declined. But I'd never forgotten it. The thing that interested me there was that people saw what was going on in the pub and they didn't bat an eyelid. They were obviously used to it. And this was in Barry Island. That's another little thing I remember.
Any other stories from that time? That was Barry, not Portsmouth. Sorry, I misunderstood off tape there.
Right. Well, now, while I was on the Blenheim, I was really marking time until my demob number came up. And I was actually over my time. Because I was working the ship's company, I couldn't be demobbed until I was replaced. So I was actually about a month beyond the time that I should have been.
So when were you demobilised?
I was demobbed in July 1946.
So and how long had you been on about? You've got no idea, really.
No, I can't remember.
3 or 4 months?
Something like that, I suppose. But anyway, while I was on the Blenheim, I had a telegram. And the telegram said, son and airborne. And my first child was born while I was on the Blenheim. And that's what the telegram was about. And my son was born on Derby Day in 1946. And we'd had a sweepstake on the ship, and I'd drawn White Jacket. And I thought, well, my wife was in the hospital to have the baby, and I thought the nurses and the doctors, White Jacket, but it came nowhere. And I wish I'd have had the telegram on the day of the Derby, but I didn't get it until the day afterwards. And it said, son and airborne. And airborne won the Derby in 1946 at 40-1. And I thought, what a wonderful tip, son and airborne. And airborne was the one that won the Derby in 1946. Anyway, because the baby had been born, again, like I was drunk on my 21st birthday, I got sippers around the mess again and got drunk on rum. And after I had my dinner, I went up on the bridge of the Blenheim. Remember, this was in June, and it was hot. And the lads covered me up with some bunting, some flags, keep me out of harm's way till I'd sobered up. And when I woke up, about 6 in the evening sort of thing, came down, feeling a bit the worse for wear, they said, the officer of the day wants to see you. And when I went to see the officer of the day, he said, I believe you've applied for compassionate leave because your wife's had a baby. I hadn't applied for compassionate leave. The lads had done it for me while I was drunken up on the bridge. And because it was warm weather, I got sunburnt on the arms where they hadn't covered me up. And he said to me, I suppose you haven't got any warrants left to travel up the line. So I said, no, sir, have you done them all up? He said, well, I'll grant you a compassionate warrant. And the next morning, I came up the line, and my wife had been evacuated from London to have the baby to St. Neots in Hertfordshire, away from the bombing.
No bombing in 1946.
No, but the scheme was still on, where women in London were evacuated to have their babies. The scheme was still on. And she got the baby. I came up to London. My mother-in-law was out. I got in through the bathroom window of the flat in Islington, left her a note, went down to King's Cross or Euston Station, can't remember which, got a train to St. Neots, and remember the chap I was with when I was picked up by the drafting commander Portsmouth, Tom Noakes. Well, Tom Noakes came from St. Neots. And I went to the police station and we looked up the voters list and we found out where his father lived in St. Neots. And the policeman lent me his bike and I cycled in my bell bottoms from the police station to this house. And I spent a couple of days with Tom's dad. He put me up while I was visiting my wife in the nursing home at St. Neots when my first child was born. So that's another little story. And then, of course, eventually, about 4 weeks later after his birth in July, I think it was about the 15th of July, something like that, I was demobbed.
What was the procedure when you were demobbed?
Well, that was interesting because I had to come off the Blenheim and go up to Portsmouth, and I was demobbed from a place called Fort Southwark. They were using it as a demob base. And I have a feeling it was the place where Eisenhower planned D-Day. But it's a little bit vague in my mind. Anyway, I went into this camp. I got my kit bag, my hammock and my case. And when I went in there, I had to have a medical. Two things about the medical. One is I was suffering badly with earache. And I didn't want to tell the doctors. I didn't want to delay my demob. So I didn't tell them. When I went to the doctor in Civvy Street, I got a perforated eardrum. And they gave me my demob suit and all the rest of it.
What did you think of the suit?
Not a lot. But the overcoat was all right. I enjoyed the overcoat. But the suit itself, I can't remember much about it.
Would you use it? I mean, did people actually
Well, I'd have to use it in Civvy Street, yeah. My first job was as an insurance agent, so I wore it. I don't remember much about it. But I do remember I had a trilby, which I never wore, they gave me, and also this overcoat. The overcoat I definitely wore. But the hammock was no longer any use to me, and there was some civilian people in this camp, and they were buying the little mattress that went with the hammock because it had horsehair in it. And horsehair was rather hard to come by at the time, evidently. And they were giving chaps a few bob for their hammocks. So I sold mine for whatever it was. And some chaps had just abandoned their hammocks and couldn't get out the camp quick enough. So I just picked up those and sold a few of those at the same time. And then those are little things I remember. But the actual demob, the other part of the medical was you had to strip off naked for the doctors to examine you. And I remember them asking me to walk up and down. And one doctor said to me, "Well, I don't think the Navy's done you much harm," because I was a big lad. I had lost weight, but a lot of the people who came out of the Navy were extremely thin, with bad living conditions, food and stuff like that. But I'd gone in fairly well nourished. I was not quite so well nourished when I came out, but compared with the average, I suppose I was. And that's what was his comment. He said, "Hasn't done you much harm." But he didn't know about the perforated eardrum at the time.
Now, what were you going to do when you came out? Because your job, you'd been an assurance agent, hadn't you? But that was in Liverpool.
Yes.
Now, you weren't going to live in Liverpool anymore, were you?
Right. Tell you what happened there. So I came from my demob centre to London, where we were living with my mother-in-law in a one-bedroom flat in Islington with a four-week-old baby. And I went home from there to Liverpool, where I was going to share the house with my father and mother and sister. It was a three-bedroom house in Liverpool, and I was going to share a bedroom there and share half the expense of the house with my dad. But money I'd been sending home to my mother to save for me, etc., it's a long story there, I won't actually go into all the details, but she had spent, and there was no money there for me. And I was very upset about this, and there was a sort of a family row. And my dad said to me, "Well, when you bring your wife up here and the baby, you'll need the second largest bedroom." Prior to going in the Navy, I'd had the small box room because it didn't worry me what size the room was. But my sister got this second size bedroom, and she had the screaming abdab. She went hysterical because I said to her, "Well, I can't get a double bed and a cot in the box room. It's impossible." You know, but she didn't see that at the time. She just thought I'd come home, and she just had the screaming abdabs, and she went hysterical. Well, what with my parents, my mum spending my money, and everything else, my wife rang, and I said to her, "I'm coming back down to London. I'm not staying up here. No way could I bring that young baby here with all this lot going on." So the next morning, I packed the case, and Dad was going off to work. He was pushing his bike down the path, and I just said, "I won't be here when you get back, Dad. I'm going down to London," and I'll never forget what he said to me. He said, "You won't get an £8 a week job down in London. You'll be back with your tail between your legs." And that was the best thing my father ever did to me, because it, where I was easy going and all the rest of it, he stiffened up my resistance. I thought, "I bloody well show you." And I came down determined. I never spoke to my parents or saw them until my son was 5 years of age. So the first 5 years of his life, he never saw his grandparents. But it did help me. When I went back to Liverpool 5 years later, I went with my first car to my sister's wedding.
Now, what job did you do? I mean, you'd been an assurance agent. What did you do in London?
I tried to get a job with the Prudential Assurance Company, but I was too young. I was 21. You needed to be 25. And I went along Holloway Road, Islington, and I went into the Refuge Assurance Company, and they took me on as an insurance agent. Assurance agent, for the Refuge. And I rode a bicycle around Islington. I slept on the living room floor on a mattress at my mother-in-law's place, and that's how I started off. And I did that for quite a while. I hated it. I didn't like the job, asking people to take out new policies. I worked all around King's Cross, which was a rough neighbourhood, a lot of houses there, which later on when I became a health inspector, I pulled down a slum clearance. And in those days, in the summer, my customers used to go hop picking. And when they went hop picking, when they came back, they'd be in arrears with their insurance. They'd say, "Just take 1 week and 6 months off the arrears." And round about Christmas, I'd just get them a bit straight again. And then the Christmas presents would be there, and we start all over again in the new year. I found it hard going, but that was the job. So I applied after a while to go for training as an environmental health officer, because under the Resettlement Act, if you could prove that your career was interrupted or prevented by your war service, you could get a government grant to retrain. So I applied and they turned me down. And I appealed and they turned my appeal down. And I appealed against that to the tribunal. I won the day. They could not understand that while I was on a ship doing Atlantic convoys, I couldn't train as an environmental health officer. And I kept on saying, "Well, while I'm doing it, my career has been prevented." They said, "But you hadn't started, it hadn't been interrupted." I said, "Of course it wouldn't start. I knew I was going to be called up. I registered at 17 and a half. How could I start training when I was going to be called up? I'm claiming it was prevented. That's what the Act says." But they were stupid, or I don't know. But I had to fight tooth and nail to get the grant. And I hadn't got a place of my own to live. I slept on a mattress at my mother-in-law's place. I kept on having a go at Islington Council for accommodation. And eventually I got a requisition place. They said I couldn't have a permanent flat because I wasn't of a permanent character. And when I said, they said, "Well, you're a young man, you can have more in family." We're keeping the new flats for older families. I said, "When you've been a council tenant for a while, you can transfer." So after a while, about a year or two, I asked to transfer. They said, "Well, now you can't have it because you're now adequately housed."
And you made your career as an environmental health inspector. That was your career, wasn't it?
That's what I wanted to do, and that's what I did all the way through, yeah.
Now, the only other thing to cover is your stuff with the Royal Naval Association. Could you just briefly describe to us what attracted you to it and the rest of it?
My next-door neighbour, when I was living in Tottenham, was a member of the Royal Naval Association and asked me a number of times to go with him and join, but I was very busy with my job as an environmental health officer, and I really didn't think I got much in the way of time to go. Looking back now, I wish I'd have joined the Royal Naval Association earlier. But that was the reason I never joined. Well, how did I get into...
Well, just tell us what was so important?
I know it was. I had learned to read the Daily Mirror during wartime. It was a popular paper, and I continued to buy it when I was demobbed. And they had a part of the Daily Mirror called Live Letters, and I used to read these. And there was a live letter one day from somebody called Tony Story about captain class frigates. And this was a letter from my old chief, Tony Story, in the Daily Mirror. I got in touch with the Daily Mirror, and through the Daily Mirror, I got his telephone number and rang him. And by the time I rang him, he had come out of the Navy, he'd become a policeman, he'd retired from the police, and he was living down in Somerset. And I rang him, and he said to me, "Are you going over to Normandy for the anniversary of D-Day?" And I said, "Well, I haven't done anything." He said, "I think we've got some spare seats on our coach." So I went with the Normandy branch, the Cornish branch of the Normandy Veterans Association, and Tony Story, my old chief. And we went across to France for the 40th anniversary. He said, "Bring your medals." Well, the medals I'd been sent in a little cardboard box were still in a cardboard box. I'd never worn them. I said, "Medals?" He said, "Yeah, bring your medals." So I took my medals. I'd never worn them. And when we were on the coach going along to Normandy, he said, "Get your medals out." And they were still in the box. I had no idea how to put them on. I didn't even know that there was a sequence to medals. And on the coach, he's pinning these medals on. He said, "I had to look after when you're a young sprog, when you first came on your ship." He said, "Now, all these years later, I'm still having to look after you." So off we went for the 40th anniversary of D-Day into Normandy. Well, he belonged to, had been belonged to the Borehamwood branch of the Royal Naval Association. And his brother-in-law still belonged to it. And through his brother-in-law, Bernie Howe, who was also in the Navy, I joined the Borehamwood branch of the Royal Naval Association, and I've been with them ever since.
What do they do? I mean, why is it important to you?
Well, when you're with a number of ex-sailors, it's like, call it Freemasonry. There's a special relationship, something that we've all had in common, even at one stage when I belonged to the British Legion. You still don't get that comradeship that we have in the Navy, even in the British Legion. It's hard to put into words, but there is comradeship, and it's nice to be with your shipmates, and we help one another, and we enjoy the company, we tell one another yarns. We have a drink together. We have our wives with us.
And where do you meet?
We meet at the British Legion over in Borehamwood. I'm secretary over there. And we meet once a month. And we go out to trips to other branches. We have entertainment laid on, music, a buffet. And... we reciprocate. We celebrate Trafalgar night. We have a dinner and Christmas parties, raffles.
Is it mainly Second World War veterans, or is it all that? You know, I mean, it's meant to be all ages, isn't
it? It's most meant to be all ages, but unfortunately, we haven't got a lot of youngsters coming in, and they're mostly people of my own age and similar. There are a number of people who belong who are not ex-sailors. They are associate members. Some of them are ex-army, but they like being with us, and they're good members. And, of course, our wives are associate members. So some people are members only by association.
And what about, you're also a member of the Captain's Class Association. Is that important to your...
Not particularly. The Royal Naval Association is much more important. The Captain Class Association is interesting because it was a captain class, but I'm not as close to the people there as I am with the Royal Naval Association.
Have you been to any of their meetings? I mean, do they have...
Yes, I have.
Have you met some of the veterans?
Yes, I have. I've been several times. I usually go with Vic Tizard, and we've met a chappie, Don Yeomans, who was coxswain of the Sprag. He usually meets us there. We go to a hotel up in the Midlands, and I've been to several of them. I'm not going to this next one, mainly because I'm going over to Normandy, and it's a question of, you know, you can't go to everything.
Indeed, Don. Thank you very much.